Recording.
So let's call to order the regular meeting of the North Bend Planning Commission for Thursday, January 26, 2017. First item of business is to approve tonight's agenda. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
And a second?
Second.
So a motion by Commissioner Luckey and a second by Commissioner Gildersleeve. Any comments or changes? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
The agenda is approved unanimous. Next item of business is approval for minutes for January 12, 2017 Planning Commission meeting. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Motion by Commissioner Luckey and a second?
Second.
Second by Commissioner Von Trapp. Any discussion or comments or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes for January 12th say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved. It's unanimous. Next item on the agenda is public comment on non-agenda items. Seeing no one from the public present, we will move on to item number four, which is amendments to cottage housing regulations. Ms. Eastep, would you like to begin?
Sure. So what we did is we left off basically, if my notes are right, on about page, we got through seven, but I don't think we got through, we were on eight, because time, always, you know, the 2 weeks makes a difference. I don't know if you just want to pick up where you left off, or if you want to, that's probably the easiest, but. Yeah, okay.
Elizabeth, so we had gone through these and we had made some comments, and I didn't know if you wanted to just run through if you have anything before that.
My main item is on page three.
Page three.
That last section. There's just something about the sentence that starts these standards and ends more affordable housing choices. And I think it may be a punctuation issue, or just the way it runs in between the more reasonably priced housing options, often more affordable housing choices. There's something that just doesn't quite work there, and I'm not sure if we need a semicolon or if we just need to rephrase that section.
In our general conversation, the entire commission just had a question about using the term affordable housing because of what it kind of brings up in your mind. And so I see that it's highlighted, but I didn't know if you came back with any thoughts on if it's appropriate, if you want to change it to something, and if there's anything to change it to, just before we go changing the structure of the sentence.
Well, I added in the language. I actually didn't highlight it probably correctly. We added in the language. It used to be more. Let me go back to what it was. But
more affordable housing choices.
Often more affordable. And then I added the word reasonably priced because what we talked about was we talked about adding reasonably priced or just – so it was kind of a placeholder of maybe let's think about this. And I actually didn't highlight the fact that I had that. So the gist of a conversation was these aren't going to be affordable per some government, you know, 80% of median income. But because they are smaller, they'll naturally or theoretically be less expensive than some of the bigger houses. But when you start finishing them with really nice interior finishes, they could equally get, or just they could quickly get equal to what it would be.
Call them smaller.
If I could make a suggestion.
Uh-huh.
Sure. So from the need for smaller, more diverse, and of a varying scale of price point, would that address what you're trying to say there without getting into, because I think that when we talk about reasonably priced housing, that's also a...
Yeah, that's subjective, yeah.
And affordable housing does have a very clear definition that's used frequently that doesn't work, but to convey that thought without making it...
I like where you're going. I'm just thinking about price point. Is there anything that we could do?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the question is one of our goals to create affordability by creating this zone or regulating the zone the way it is? Because previously that was the council's intent. Like, let's create this cottage zone. And even the cottage company came in and said, yeah, these aren't really affordable. And they're definitely not going to hit any affordable governmental programs. So then it's more like, I'm almost wondering if we should don't, we, none of us, I think, feel they're going to be affordable. So how do we want to recognize that, or do we want to build something into it that...
We all feel that they can be lower cost. Is that correct?
No.
No, okay.
Yeah, that's I don't either. I kind of...
You can't pour a foundation that's fitting a 1,500 square foot house, build a second living level on top of that, and then the vaulted, whatever you do, for less money than you can build 50% more. It's practically the same money to build it.
So, just to kind of add to that, going back and thinking about last week's discussion, and then when we were talking about the zoning, when the area that we intended for this was the HDR, you know, not necessarily the cottage, if I remember correctly, and that being kind of the zoning area for lower, more affordable, high-density housing that we do need, but, you know, targeting it there. So I get that this might be councils, but, like, let's remind ourselves that's what our intentions were. Obviously, they can do with, you know, what they wish. But maybe we're just trying to put something in that we didn't intend to begin with. You know, we're fit.
Commissioner Wright.
Would the commission agree just to put a period of the word often and strike the last four words of that sentence?
I could do better.
Or before often.
Yeah, it would be after more... smaller and more diverse, and then
strike out the more affordable housing choices,
and then leave housing choices, because you would keep more diverse housing choices.
Hmm. So how do you read more diverse
housing
options,
housing choices, and just get rid of talking
about affordable?
You would
strike and often more affordable housing, you would strike and
reasonably
often
priced, reasonably priced housing options. Period.
I think you strike it from the word preferably. Mm-hmm. All the way through to providing.
Well, remember, you have two. Okay, so there's two thoughts. This is an error. We were talking about adding, instead of saying more affordable housing choices, we thought reasonably. So the way it had been written was more affordable. So you could do what you're doing. But
is there any place else?
The reasonably price isn't even part of that.
Why even talk about price? Why is that so
important?
That's where
this was a note to myself.
Yeah, phrasing it in a way that doesn't say you can't do that, but also doesn't call it out as so that people don't look at this and go, oh, that's what they want, and I can't come in here and do a higher-end cottage housing project. Just get rid of anything that talks about price.
Is there any place else in the code where we've discussed price of the finished product?
No, and I don't think so. The one thing I do know is affordable, and the whole discussion of affordability is, I think,
it's loaded.
It's kind of, well, and it's starting to really be discussed, from city to city, even it was on the council's retreat. So I feel that creating affordable housing is almost a program in itself. And so you're right, what we're creating here is a smaller house to give options for buyers and diversity. So price is kind of a different topic, and we should address affordability citywide,
right,
versus little zone. So I'd say, yeah, take it out.
I would say that a lot of retirement age people are opting into smaller lots, but very pricey structure.
Right.
Yep.
So we could actually say these are very expensive homes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it could be a very simple sentence that says these standards are intended to provide a variety of housing options, which hits on the quality, price, households.
Mm-hmm.
I was just saying, I think leaving it at that is sufficient.
Yeah, I mean, I struck it. I added in that last two lines, after more diverse, I added the word housing choices, and then struck the remainder of the second, or that last sentence there, up to the word providing. And I think that covers, you've got the choices part of it covered, but not talking about pricing of anything.
Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to me, is like, as I've read through this, and I remember the conversation with the city council when it first brought up cottage. Everybody's got a vision of what a cottage is. Well, it's morphed itself into, well, here's an opportunity for us to talk about affordable housing.
Gingham window shutters. And
yeah, and it's you know, never, that function doesn't belong in our code, if I could sew it that way. The concept of pricing for the market is not, shouldn't even be thought of in my mind. If you want to design structures and design mobility, design how things function, okay, but if you start trying to dial in on what something's going to cost, it's going to get skewed, and the market's going to do what it's going to do 5 years after we've written this, because that's by the time the house gets sold.
So, unless we're going to do something specifically towards our regulated standards.
And I was going to say, if we're going to go down that road, it needs to go hand in hand with some kind of subsidy that's not market driven. And that happens all the time. All over Snoqualmie Ridge, there were, you know, the developer was told, hey, you can build X number of units, or you can build X plus units if a percentage of those are affordable housing. Now, if you go back and drive through those neighborhoods today, you realize what happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a good idea mm-hmm. for the city. Maybe a good idea for some folks who live in there. But so anyway, that's
okay. So two cents. Be clear on your change. You are recommending we strike "and often more affordable," and then everything from providing to the end of the paragraph.
Yeah, so the sentence would read, if everybody agrees, these standards are intended to address the changes, the changing composition of households and the need for smaller, more diverse housing choices, period.
Okay, we all agree?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. All right, Ms. Gildersleeve.
That was the main thing that jumped out to me, except to just comment that you can something other than that blue highlight in the future. It makes it really different difficult.
Different minutes. Yeah. On the computer.
I've had that challenge with myself before, but to
you didn't put on your 3D glasses?
You know, luckily they send it to us in our email. That makes it possible to read folks.
Did anybody run the word walk by Deagle?
You mean, in the realm of, like, excluding other people, yeah. No, that was what, no.
Because the vision I have is this gets codified, and somebody from somewhere unrelated to anything this code's writing about is going to say the city has a bent against people with lacking mobility.
Yeah.
Because we've written it that way.
I don't think, the way this is written is, it's it's written based on a the time for an average person to walk. That doesn't disclude, you could argue a slow person. So walk radius and stuff, that's kind of standard practice in the planning world. When you brought that up, I thought, could we come up with a different word than walk radius?
Is it a technical term? Is it a technical?
Cities design around walkability, so you want have the concept based on the average person to walk, even if they are in, some assisted mobility situation.
Right, right. Okay.
It's still, yeah.
It's kind of a measuring unit now.
Yeah.
Does that come from the same book as A Crow Flies?
I didn't pick that out yet, guys.
That's right.
I was trying to slice it out.
I saw it too. It's code red. Leave it in there, I say.
We'll have to add it to the definition. Make it like.
I like you guys.
All right. So we're back to page 8. Unless Elizabeth, you had more.
Okay. I actually have one. Sorry.
Go ahead.
This is one of those that kind of struck me as interesting. So we've got several places you mentioned two-unit home.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't sound. It's kind of oxymoron. See how you have one home or you have two homes. Not having a two-unit home. Again, is that a technical term that I'm just not familiar with? Like, for example, I see it on page 5 under item C, garages. It says a two-unit home.
And it means residential structure.
Two-unit, well, yeah, okay.
If that doesn't bother you, then I'm okay. It just kind of struck me as like, well, hang on a minute.
Two-unit home?
Yeah, that's a...
Now we got ADU in the...
I think this is becoming... I have the question, what happened to the term duplex, triplex, and fourplex?
Yep.
And they're not using those terms anymore, and I'm catching up to that. I have a niece in Iowa where she's looking at moving into a two-unit home. I said, that's a duplex. No, it's a duplex, the two-unit home. The whole street are duplexes, but they're called homes.
Yeah.
We do still use it in our code in quite a few areas, but...
Duplex?
Yeah.
But is there an overall change or something in the style of writing where we would like to gender-neutral language that we're calling everything a home?
I was going
to
say, it's a softer push than what the duplex sounds like. Yeah.
Well, the reason, remember, the gist was the city council wanted to give you guys the starting point of using Kirkland Code, and they were very, very specific on how that... So what I didn't want to do was change much of Kirkland Code other than what changes you made. So they do use two-unit and three-unit. I think it is that there is a vent or a plex means more of a, versus a home, it's more of a...
Is it a home or a building?
Well, you're right. The way the word, it's, I mean, Kirkland Code uses two- and three-unit homes. I think home, without an S. I don't think it's that much... you know, I don't think we need to worry about it too much. But
I'm okay with the change. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to understand it, if this is the way that we want to go, or if there's a disconnect. Well,
is an eight-unit home an apartment?
Yeah.
I mean, when does a home become an apartment in this vernacular?
Do you guys want to use duplex, triplex?
I mean, it's clear what that is.
Other definitions.
Yeah.
Why don't we do this?
It could be cottage instead of home.
It can be a duplex home.
Two-unit cottage? That didn't work at all either. Too small, right?
We do define two-unit home in this... let's hear it. You guys, let me table that one. You know, I mean, from a purely high level, it's not. So it doesn't really...
Yeah.
If you guys want to use the term duplex, we could go through and change that. I do think, though, that there was kind of a little bit of... It does create maybe a little bit different comfort feeling. I don't know. I'm happy to change it either way.
We're all about the warm fuzzy, you know.
Just
like about the PC, and everybody understands the duplex, triplex, to get the two, tri, and four.
Let me see what Fred Goldsway does.
Well, and you're dealing with the contractors and builders more than...
One of the differences that I noticed between a duplex and a two-unit home is in the housing types defined. It says that it's a structure containing two dwelling units designed to look like a detached single-family home. So that, whereas a duplex often, you know, has two separate entrances, and it's obvious there's two.
What I'm talking about that I've been seeing in Iowa is a perfectly single structure with each with two entrances on the side.
Mm-hmm.
Not the two garages in front, the side entrance.
Right.
That looks like a single home from the street.
And they're calling it a two unit.
And they're calling it a home.
Mm-hmm.
And
so
I'm saying to myself, so I was looking at it as a home, then looking to rent this place. Mm-hmm. I said, do you realize this is not a home, this is a duplex, but they're still calling it a home. The realtor's calling it a home, which is freaking me out. So I'm thinking they don't know they're buying a duplex or getting into a duplex, but they are getting into one half.
Mm-hmm.
So it's generational.
I actually think Lynn has a very good point.
If we're going to define it as such that it is something different than a duplex, then it makes a complete sense.
It includes the kind of the almost the design, a look and feel for it as well, as opposed to being the two obvious. Maybe, you know, you walk inside one main door and then there's two units that go off, but from the street it looks like a single family home. And I think that's where the difference in our code, I don't know about.
I had a duplex, I own a duplex down in North Bend, Oregon. In North Bend, Oregon, they'd have duplexes on every corner, but they were standalone, looked like a home.
Right.
So you had normal single-family homes on the corners, there'd be duplexes. They looked just like a single-family home. In that context, you probably would call it a duplex home.
Yeah.
It was one roof, two doors.
Why don't we go with duplex and keep the same, because even if describing it like Lynn described it, they have to meet this code. So whether it's called a duplex or a two-unit home, it still has to be designed to look like a single-family structure.
Yeah.
So okay. It's really not, I think, something that you guys want to get too hung up on. We can. Our code elsewhere does talk about duplexes, so this will be just where maybe it's a little bit designed differently, unless you think it's important to.
The only, I think the connotation's a little different between one sounds more like multifamily, where one doesn't sound as much like multifamily.
I agree with that.
But that's.
I have no problem with two unit homes. And I think it.
That works for me.
So whatever works for you. Okay, we'll stick with two unit homes.
Commissioner Lucky?
Yeah. I just had another thing at the bottom of page 5. That last. It starts off with the second last line. Of up to 24 units shall be separated from another cottage development of up to 24 units by either. And I'm wondering why we have either. Why not just pick something?
Okay, so we had talked about coming back to that. Hey, right, the blue just does not work. On my screen, you guys, it's perfect, so sorry. You're on page 5. Let me get to it.
And transition to page 6 looks like it's missing something, maybe, as well. Like whatever the either is.
It's either A or B, it looks like.
Well, within the 10-minute rock radius, it's different. So, it's A unless you're within the 10-minute rock radius. You defer to B.
Okay. That makes sense.
Can I just do, measure from the shortest distance between two parcels?
Do we know?
Yeah,
what,
I don't know.
What is that? General, what is the radius of a 10-minute walk?
We're going to put in a map.
What do we think that is?
We thought it was...
A quarter mile?
It's a quarter mile.
Quarter mile, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. So instead of doing it...
3 foot strides, 2 second intervals.
Yeah, it's kind of the average person. So we're going to go out on a field trip and everyone has to leave one point and map how far you can go. No, we have a mapping process where you can do it to follow the road. And, so it's.
Well, as you know what pacing is. And if I'm walking 10 minutes, pacing 10 minutes, it's going to be at least a quarter mile, maybe even a half mile.
Yeah. So the standard, though, that people use when talking about planning is a quarter mile, because the average person at, not a pacing, logging pace, walks a quarter mile in 10 minutes.
Yeah. Why not call it a quarter mile?
Well, there's a couple things. The walk radius I wouldn't worry about, because we are trying to create walkability, and this housing type is all about walkability.
I'll challenge you on the 10-minute versus quarter mile, because 10 minutes, I don't take into account that it's a straight line. A quarter mile, I think of it more of a straight line.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. So
if it was a bar between me and the quarter mile, it would be about a half an hour distance.
You need to walk home. If you walk there, I think about 5.
This is pretty good. So, this is pretty good. So instead of
social and political ramifications of Goldilocks and the three bears, shall we?
So instead of as a crow flies, we're going to say by the shortest distance.
That sounds great.
I kind of like crow flies.
It's very charming. Very charming.
It's very, very rural.
It is very rural. It painted a picture, didn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, now we're back to technical. Okay, so. Anybody else, or are we up to 8, page 8?
Did you know they used a crow call in the Predator movie?
Now that I think about it, you're
right. On page 6, we talked about tree retention.
Yeah.
And so that mentions 19.10.
Yeah.
And in the last meeting I raised, are we going to be a little more firmer based on what we've seen as clearing and actually specifying our code? Do we want those trees kept as a meandering through the lot? 19.10 in that code says 60 feet tall and 18 feet in diameter.
I don't know exactly.
18 inches. Sorry, did I say feet?
So it's 15 inches for an evergreen and 12 for a deciduous tree, measured at 4.5 feet tall, kind of your standard chest height, is a significant tree, if that's the code you're looking at.
Yeah. Is that what DSH stands for?
Diameter is standard height, yeah, I think is what it is. Or, yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's 4.5 feet.
So, 60 feet, 18 inches, is that okay as a significant size, or do we want to, you know, eventually entertain something different? And if so, how should it look throughout the site? Should we think about the open space and the green space, the borders, or, as Jim was saying, you can't be too specific on this because the roots get damaged through heavy equipment moving through, and it prevents or presents a risk years later.
An 18-inch tree is a commercially thinnable tree, and that would be a significant tree.
Okay.
One thing we don't want to do is we don't want to create, and this has been happening, and we're really going to be sticklers on this. We don't want to create different sections of the code that are different than actually the tree regulations. So,
and I don't, yeah. I'm not wanting to do that. Yeah. I would want you to bring those codes.
Right, like that's
if,
okay.
If the commission felt.
Yeah.
Yes, I agree 100% to change it at the source.
I remember back in the day, King County was calling a 10-inch tree a significant tree. You could really be loved at Norbert's Howell because 10-inch trees are not hard to find. I mean, they're not that significant.
Yeah.
Now, but they are, if you have a 10-inch tree, it's definitely rooted in the ground. It's there to stay, but I wouldn't call it significant.
Wait, is there a level above significant?
You mean like super significant?
Major historic significant?
Yeah.
There used to be. It was taken out actually a couple. There was heritage trees.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And that actually, I think there's merit to heritage trees. Our 6-7 years ago, the city council did take that out. And those were trees of, you know, 80 years or what have you. We do plan on bringing the tree code back. One thing, remember, we're going to take our time on this code because I'm really actually thinking through every time we kind of tweak this or talk about this. You know, I'm kind of, it's a unique zone and it's highly regulated. Anytime you highly regulate something, you usually run into a problem you didn't foresee. So I do feel like we need to take time on this. And then the reason why I haven't really created a new map or anything is as you guys get through this, maybe what we want to focus on more is high level, what you want to see. And then if we need to come back with new language, we can come back with that. Because where I'm thinking that's going to apply is more as we talk about for example, we could say it needs to comply with 1910. However, you know, those trees shall be preserved. Trees shall be integrated through the entire site and not clustered. That being said, clustering trees actually helps them survive. So, you know,
should be clustered throughout the site. But there should be something, and that's what I'm not sure what it should be. But mm-hmm. I think that we would all agree based on feedback and sentiment that we can improve that. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I think that I thought this all afternoon as I was reading this. Why aren't we thinking in terms of a commission going on a field trip and looking at on the ground neighborhoods that we're talking about Kirkland? Get into Kirkland as a group and look at what the city is seeing, why they're so enamored by it, and see if we can buy into it. I'd rather just do that and continue to wonder what it is as we're reading the page. Maybe that when we see it, this will all make sense to us.
Good suggestion.
You specifically talking about cottage developments?
Cottage.
Developments that are done?
Yeah. What have they done at Kirkland that's making our council so excited? I mean, I'm excitable. I'm going to go ziplining in a week. But...
Jenna, in the past, Mike took the commission to the low-impact design homes in Issaquah Highlands. So mm-hmm. I would think he would know or somebody would know how we need to message that or announce it and be
anything that we would have.
Yeah, we could do you could do two things. You could do a field trip, and we would have to decide if we're going to rent a van and how we want to do that. And it does become basically public has to drive separately and meet us there, and it's open to the public there. Is I remember that's how we did the councils. Or we could give you the address, and you guys can drive by it on your own in the 2 weeks, unless you feel like you want some other than just seeing it. So there's, different ways to do it.
We'd be forming a quorum, obviously, if we went to.
Yeah, it has to become a public meeting and published, and published as a special meeting. And,
But if we could divide ourselves up and go at separate times.
You can go by on your own. Like, that's what I said. Like, I could give you the address. You could, if you're in Kirkland, you could drive by it. I mean, you definitely can see it from the road. I'd be happy to, if you wanted to, do it into, if you guys wanted to have kind of.
I think having back and forth is important. Now, can we see it, but we should be able to discuss it.
I'd even take it another step. Most of those communities are excited to show, not inside their units. Tell them it's a unit, right? But they're in, usually there's a great house or a break room, community center room that. I mean, we could get really wild with it and have our meeting there. Get a little tour and have an actual full-on conversation about it instead of our next.
Well, I could reach out to Linda Pruitt and see if she'd be willing to host us at the site.
Yeah. Okay. And so if not, you can email out us the address, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, we could, so let's see here, how can we, drive separately, actually. We just can't talk about business on the way, so I know the van was a little difficult the last time.
Yeah, I mean, that's logistical stuff. I mean, we'll carpool. I can get six people in the back.
Yeah,
pickup.
I mean, we could get in two different cars.
I have two car seats.
Oh, yeah, yes. We'll get in for this.
Yeah.
You guys would have to schedule it earlier, though. You'd have to do an early meeting.
Oh, sure. I'm thinking all afternoon.
Daylight.
Daylight.
Yeah. So you'd want to do a planning commission tour of like two.
Is it just one neighborhood in Kirkland that we're all crazy about? It must be more than that.
Well, there's one specific cottage company.
It's not so much that the Kirkland one is the end-all, be-all. It's actually a really nice development. But the code has been codified and it's buildable. And that's why the actual regulations that enable it are the, like, you know, there's other, we could be copying Federal Ways regulations or these regulations or that regulation, but the ones that were codified under the, produced a product that is attractive, and that's why the starting point. And it's only the starting point.
And is this what they had on Kirkland, like, what, 40 homes out of 500 come in, or is it pretty developed out?
No. The regulations that you see here, where you can't do more than 24. So Kirkland does it different. Every other city does it different. In other cities, cottages are infill into your low density, into your yellow zone, your 4D per acre zone. In those zones, what they say is you can put a cottage development up to 24 homes. And to do it, you get double the density. So if you are in a 4D per acre zone, you could go up to 8, but you're required to build these small homes.
This ESTA, you just turn the light on for me. I'm in the dark.
Okay.
To say that this is, that cottage is intended to be an infill to other residential, that is awesome.
Right.
See, I thought we were going to have a strip of these down Cedar Falls Road.
No, see, that's why when you...
So this is very creative in my mind.
Yeah, so what we're trying to do, this is why this code I keep coming back to and saying we're going to take our time on it, because what this code does is it artificially creates an infill. So
So that's why when you go to that separation, you say, we're saying you have to, remember, we're saying you have to separate it by these. You have to separate it two 12 packs, get separated by a 35-foot buffer, and then a standard neighborhood of not more than 20 units, and then a buffer, and then just so this is
so you have that much. They have that much in curtain. Those two or three pots.
No, this isn't the same. The equity. This is more equal in number. The cottages are naturally what we did by picking 20. Is we're saying there'll be more cottages than single family homes in this neighborhood. Kirkland and other areas is actually flipped. But we already have a lot of the 3,000 square foot homes, so we're actually incentivizing this neighborhood. Now, the benefit of doing a cottage development, if we allow the density in this area to be higher, is you can flip that extra land into open space. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to kind of allow the same amount of homes on less land, basically, and the less land, the excess goes into tree preservation and other things we wouldn't have gotten if we just let people build the way they were building. So we are creating kind of an infill environment for that corridor. But now that being said, we're also saying the lots along Cedar Falls are to remain LDR. So we're also putting these cottages behind so they won't be up in, yeah. So there's visually, in my mind, if this turned out, visually you would, Cedar Falls would maybe have two or three more homes along the frontage, and the cottages would be behind those. And we're requiring the 15-foot tree buffer. We're really trying to retain that buffer. And Lynn and I, like I told you last time, are really going to try to work with our engineering to try to get some vegetation over that sewer line. So that's 15 feet of just waste space that could be beautiful trees in time. And so that's another opportunity. So there'd be 30 foot of vegetation before you see like the first house. And that's a pretty different nature. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see what I'd like to get the Kirkland site. Mm-hmm.
So,
I had a footnote to add some estimate, another perhaps even brighter light. The original function of Kirkland's cottage came from truly an infill, but it was even more. It was a troubled lot. It was I believe it was 5 or 7 acres, could have been subdivided into two lots. It had slope, it had wetlands,
that's
it had
true.
Issues.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
And so the reason that Kirkland went for it was they said, look, we're going to not even use a half of the lot that we could otherwise build a couple nice big houses on. Mm-hmm. So the end result was you basically pull down a driveway off of the main drive into a neighborhood mm-hmm. where otherwise it would have been maybe two houses and they'd have cleared every tree on the place. Mm-hmm. So that concept fits totally with what you're, the ping part. That's why I've been so excited about it. And it belongs in infill project. Mm-hmm. And because we're designing it in a way that it can feel that way after the fact, which is really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, what we're also creating is this area that's going to be difficult for any one builder to buy up a lot. Because what you're going to find is somebody's going to build cottages or they're going to build a standard neighborhood. And so you'll get at least two builders on average. I mean, I might be wrong, but that's typically how it goes. People, you know, and people are diversifying now. But that's definitely one benefit that might happen here. So.
Interesting.
So we are.
Never too old work.
So we got past the. We're past the buffer or the separation and. You guys added a really great, I think, I forget who it was, but in the blue on 6 that you can't read, it says, if the required number of parking spaces results in a fraction, the applicant shall provide the number of spaces equal to the next whole number, because so you guys added a clarity there. I thought that was a good idea. And then we got to page 7, where the edit there, who's the should or shall person, but we put a shall there.
I'm the shall guy.
We're the shall guy. So we got that clarified. And then we got rid of, this was, you guys did another great, I think, amendment here. You got rid of the vaulted space may not be converted into habitable space, and that gives people, or reduces their flexibility of their own little space, which...
And provides income opportunity for a permit.
Yeah.
That's what you're thinking about right
there. I think you said it.
And then you guys added the provision regarding, let me read this, the residential parking driveways can't be used as a guest parking spot. It can't be calculated as that. So that was the next change. And that got us to, I think, page 8. We were just, if I recall, we had, you guys had even, I believe, talked about the community building and community space.
I feel like we talked a bit about the orientation.
You did or did not?
Did. Is that right?
Yeah.
I know there was a conversation about that.
For the community building or for the buildings?
For the buildings.
Mm-hmm, we did talk about that. Oh, yeah, sorry, I'll leave you down there to orientation of the buildings. So maybe we got through 8. Does anybody have any changes on 8?
Nope.
Okay. So then we got to...
I've got a question on 9.
Yeah.
A query right on paragraph 4, talking about split rail design. That's not really a barrier for dogs and children. I think both can crawl between those rails pretty easily, unless there's something like a mesh between it or something. And I get the idea that the rails provides visibility, doesn't create a visual block, but I certainly like that design built in a way that protects youngsters who are in the backyard trying to get out.
So you can do, I'll just come around here and I'll show each one of you, but this is Daniel's Grove. It is the Kirkland product, and you'll see the split rail. And the reason why the split rail is important is these are in the front of the house. Mm-hmm. And because your house is centered around a green, which is a shared space. The idea is you don't want to cut the house off from...
Yeah, I get that.
So the spaces where you see the solid fences are in their backyards. So I'm going to show you in a good example.
But, okay.
Double screen. And I'll stop by everybody's desk. But this is... Can you see that? So that's the split rail fence.
Got it.
And that allows for that real... interactive, and then back here's their space where they could have a dog and things like that. So that's the gist of.
Kind of looks like model homes when you would drive down the street.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That low fence.
But you're definitely telling the owners they can't use the front of their house to have the kids play because the kids can wander away.
Well, remember, this is not on a street. These are required to be built.
It's like a park.
On a big park, but yeah.
I get that. Yeah. But they can still wander away with that. Family walking by, he might just decide to join them. I would.
Yeah, I would too.
They can also take a walk with fence.
Yeah. There is some personal responsibility of a parent to keep their eyes on their little kids who wander.
I know, but
like a nylon tether. I mean, the shock collars were.
And a GPS device.
Belay harness.
And a GPS device.
You know, I guess the parents have the problem. They wouldn't buy the house.
Yeah, so this is a put my dad. This is another picture. This is looking back at the community building. Yeah. So you can see the one thing that's really, you know, I believe this, it makes and breaks almost every neighborhood is landscaping, and this is so well landscaped.
Yeah. Is that the community house?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I like that.
So really you can see the people that are kind of attracted to this, what we're hearing isn't the families. It is the downsizer. Yeah. It's not even that they call them aspirational buyers, the people that are buying their first house.
and wanting to size up eventually, it's really more the downsizer or the single professional.
There's something really similar to this up on the Ridge.
Kind of. There's a couple. Yeah, no, that's why I laughed.
They're all
architectural.
Well, they're all the same unit. There's four of them. And then there's a common green in the middle. There's no
alley back.
There's no...
Yes. There's no community house.
This is off Osprey. So, Linda, for the... She built this when Snoqualmie Ridge was being built, and they came up and toured and gave Quadrant this big song and dance, just like you guys are, you know, hearing from them. I mean, they could do a great product, and that's why this is a beautiful thing. But what you want to make sure is you build a code around, not, you know, it would be great if they came and built this, but somebody else too could, you know, could have a different product. I think Snoqualmie's looks good, but it's nowhere near as well landscaped. The details aren't.
Yeah, no, it's just, it's simple.
Yeah, yeah.
Do they have the private front yard as well?
Well, no, it's more the community front yard.
Okay, that's one thing that I have learned through this process is the just the importance of having that private front yard, because that's what gets you out there, you know, like having your private area where you can go out and be working in your garden with, you know, your dog or whatnot, and then that starts to bring people to the community center.
Yeah, this has a nice balance of shared space but yet a defined, this is my yard.
I think I said early on, this some of this stuff culturally is very European, Dutch. And they, back 50, 60 years ago, it was very common for families to live in kind of shared meals, and they'd meet commonly at each other's house, basically across the walkway. We're not there yet, but it'd be kind of cool if we got there.
I think these codes, as Brian Sierra, would be better off if we had about every five pages photographs depicting what we're talking about regulating.
Mm-hmm.
No visuals is really hampers your imagination.
I know it was important to you.
So what's the address?
Oh, Daniels Road. Danielson Road. Let's see here.
The other thing is kind of a side note. Those communities that exist, they have their own marketing process for resales. So people looking for that product, they're talking to each other, which is, that's huge. Imagine that happening in a regular neighborhood, standard neighborhood.
Yeah.
So there's some do.
Further on down in this, there's talk about sidewalk walking, what we just saw there. And I made a big note, this is all BS, you know, I don't want to have somebody looking in my living room as I'm sitting there scratching my whatever,
back,
you know.
Head.
And your left ear?
Yeah. And this is really getting, you know, people in my face. I said, I don't want people that close to my front window, but showing it the way you have it, why wouldn't I want that?
Yeah, it's
that
nice.
That is really cool. And very recently I had lunch at that new Italian place, and I just love having that sidewalk right in the window, because it really puts the people walking by as part of what's inside there. I mean, it's a very friendly feeling to have people walking to the theater right past that window. It's so cool. So I'm getting there, you guys.
So Lynn made a comment, and I actually like to keep flexibility, and as they scroll through these pictures, there's actually another fence design. The gist of the split rails that it's visually penetrable, so it's inviting. So you're, because what you would fail if you tried to build that and close like a wall off to the park, so you don't notice necessarily the difference between the private space and the shared space, but you do, it's very subtle. But we could do something if we wanted to allow more flexibility in design. We could say, or other, you know, split rail fence or other visually penetrable design.
Just not to exceed.
Please don't. I didn't mean. My problem with safety for critters and kids. It's there. I can see that. Okay, my kid wanders away. He'll wander to a neighbor's house. He's not going to go too far.
Right.
But one thing I would probably do for myself would be get a 4-inch square mesh and just put in there myself and still keep it visually penetrable. But if I had something small that wanted to stay inside of that 4-inch square mesh would work. And it's not visible.
Yeah, I appreciate that comment, actually, because I have my dog. I would want my dog out with me, so. And she'd be gone through the split rail fence.
Or over it.
Mind monotony. Can barely move. Are you guys, we'll just add that, because that allows, you know, it allows, I have a neighbor-friendly fence where you can actually see through it, but it's just offset.
So why even have the fence?
Well, because I have a dog.
But I mean, let's say, why even have a little fence?
Architectural landscape.
That's because it really has no function other than the visual.
And defining space.
Yeah.
So if it's on a common area, you know not to play ball right there.
Okay, so.
I'm on number 5 on page 9, and it's the landscaping located in common open space areas. And so here's one of the points that I think we could firm up some language, but I also want to call out mature trees, and I don't know what the difference between that and our trees in 1910 are, and maybe we just want to say retain per 1910 instead of mature trees.
Well, so here's a thought. We could say significant or mature, because the one thing I've learned over the years on saving trees is the younger, the more resilient, and the better they're actually saved. So, like, something might not quite be a significant tree, or maybe, like we have a development right now that has a couple that are smaller, but they're really nice trees. So our arborist is like, oh, God, those are great trees. But they're not big enough yet to be significant. So mature actually allows a little flexibility to say, so if you want trees, I think the flexibility is good. Just clarify that instead of saying where feasible, existing mature trees shall be retained to the maximum extent feasible. There's always somebody who's going to claim that it's a danger tree.
Is there something more specific we can say about mature trees? So you're saying the arborist said this one is really healthy or is going to be a stunning tree. How can we put that as another part to mature to better describe it?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And also say your significant
tree. I would say that somewhere in the code or in your instructions to the builders that you have the arborist call, flag the trees that are by the arborist's training and common sense what a mature tree is. It may not be a mature tree to be 20 years in difference in age.
Yeah, you could say an arborist designated mature tree.
But in this neighborhood, it's going to be a fir, it's going to be a hemlock, or it's going to be a cedar, 9 times out of 10. Mm-hmm. You're lucky if you have a beautiful broadleaf tree, but that's going to be an alder.
Big leaf maple.
Do you protect non-indigenous trees the same as you do the indigenous ones?
Not in our code, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean.
But if you just say mature or you just say significant, that doesn't preclude you from having to protect something that's not indigenous.
Yeah, so some of the process you guys, you're diving deep. So what we do is every time there's a development application, we do bring in our arborists. We need provisions in the code that back up what we want to see. He will definitely have the credentials to say, this is a great tree. Yeah, let that go tree, but that tree go, but we're going to keep 3 in its place or something like that. So really what we need more is just the clear language. And that's why we need to go back into our tree code. But like right here, as you guys were talking, I wrote, to the maximum extent feasible, which is very different than where feasible, existing mature trees shall be retained throughout the site.
Okay.
So that's saying, you know, you have to really show us, you know, and everybody, that's the problem with trees. Everybody can show, like, oh, the wind pattern's going to come from this, and it's going to fall on the house this way. And, but when you have an arborist there, you know, you can have that back and forth with the developer. And then you have to rely on the max, you know, the ultimate number that you're saying retain, which Lynn actually brought something up that I think is a good thing. We have a provision in our code that allows you to drop the percentage. So you're supposed to retain 20%, and it says you can go to 10 if you do XYZ. I think in this zone, because of Cedar Falls being so nicely treed, I think we can say within this zone, the provision 1910.03.093 that allows the reduction shall not apply. Or not, you know, so we could at least require 20% off in addition to all the buffers you're building.
You know, I would.
Okay, Mr. Lucky?
As a forester, I would. I'm happy to see less major trees. Major trees add a lot, no question about it. But you don't have to have only majors. You can have smaller trees that provide a whole different feeling about having green in your face. But the big trees add that quality of that you'll miss if you take them down and only have juvenile trees and older growing up. They eventually will get to be that size, but at that point, I would lobby for not as many mature trees as I'm getting the feeling for you guys think you have to have, but I would have at least 4, maybe 5 between about every 2 houses of significant trees, and not overcrowd them with significant trees, and make sure you plant appropriate trees to bring in the understory. I could have died when Dirtfish cut the only tree on the mill site down. Yeah, it was an old growth cedar.
Oh, no, really.
Sitting right next to the old office, they took it it and the root out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I certainly
But it filled the space like half the parking lot.
I certainly have to go through our code and read it a little more closely, because I don't get where the hotel site took down some really big trees, or over by the North Bend Montessori, there's an empty lot there, and they cut down the biggest tree that was only left on the lot. And so I don't know if they weren't healthy or what it is, but it kind of makes me wonder why we don't do more for those really healthy, significant, large, you know, 50, 100-year-old trees.
What's the penalty for cutting down a tree?
$50.
Something like that. Well, you can plant.
It doesn't make you hurt.
You said... You can plant 3 for every one.
It's kind of like saying, telling Johnny not to cross the road.
Size and type.
Code enforcement is, you know, like, you can fine for code enforcement. We haven't had any scenarios where somebody took out a number of trees without a permit that I know of.
You know, so you made
the one off when somebody cuts down a tree and their neighbors are causing it.
If you suspend, if you made a hurt, if you make the penalty hurt, like suspend operations for a month.
Pardon?
Just shut them down for a month.
Yeah, that would hurt. That's, yeah.
That, they would stop cutting your trees down. Especially in the hot market.
Well, I'm remembering the big signs and gates around the trees while they were doing the project in downtown Snoqualmie that reminded the people working on the project how much that tree was going to cost them.
Oh, there were signs, huh?
Yeah, and of varying prices. I don't know exactly how they determine the value on those, but you better believe they took care of those trees.
Yeah, you know, that's why I said when we want to open up the tree code, it hasn't been, you guys actually went through it, it's been done since I've been here.
And it, 5 years.
And it got kind of not quite where I would have loved for it to be. But now it's time to come back, and part of that, like, you know, we've been implementing a lot of those conditions that you see where they put the fence around the tree via plat conditions. But we want to codify it all, so they'll come back.
So when we do that, will the arborist join us?
Definitely. I would have to have probably somebody first, if you guys get really deep into the technical aspects of
maybe that's when we need a field trip to understand the methodology of trees.
We don't have to go very far around here.
No, just go out and look.
I'm going to write the, so I'm just putting a note here that we're going to add that the that provision that I talked about shall not apply. I'll reword it. I'm just kind of giving myself a short note. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so let me head back down to, we're on page 9.
Page 9, anything else for page 9? Page 10, I have number 1. Shared detached garage structures. And I come back again to the rainy and cold nights and these people buying these homes and wanting to pour into a garage. Do you feel that we should allow detached garages for these, or do we want to include them, or do we want to have the mix that we're allowing now, I guess?
To ask a question about the shared detached garages, when we're talking about 4 garage doors, that would indicate to me that you could have 4 different unit owners, each with a section in that detached garage mm-hmm. structure. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. So in my mind, when we're thinking about it that way and how to design the lot so that they get a actual enclosed garage, it might be easier for them to have a detached garage like this than to arrange it in a way that's attached to the individual structures. I actually think it's an important piece of how this lays out.
One of the, in the same light that you use the front yard perspective to meet your neighbors, there pretty commonly amongst these developments is a removal of the vehicle from the living quarters. Everybody. Mm-hmm. So your neighbor doesn't come home and up comes their garage door, or they're running their car next door to yours. That whole concept was to try to get it away from the living structures. To your point, Dick, I totally agree with you. It may be nice to pull them out of the weather. But that's the dance. That's the choice piece. Yeah. And right. there's a cost factor that I throw in, too, yeah. Because building a garage.
We have, over the years, I'm familiar with, my grandmother had an eightplex, and it was all carport away from the living quarters. They had to walk down a walk with a walk-in door and had to bounce their groceries to get in the front door. But that was the way they lived back in the 40s, and it made the living part very convenient, very neighborly, because you didn't have all that cars, parts of the houses blocking all that. It was just, everybody had a car at the back carport, period. Mm-hmm. And it was, no one whined about it, they just lived with it. And it was very accommodating in terms of what you're showing us here, how people are living in these ways. Without having the car on the way.
That's true. It's actually a big part of making this a successful cottage, because it's really about the people and not the car, the way these are designed.
It does provide a little more flexibility and less paving is needed at some times, and the ability to save more significant trees if you don't need the road going right up to each, you know, if you could.
Well, yeah, in this particular unit I'm talking about, I had to see it vividly. There was a driveway on both sides of the property line. Mm-hmm. goes to the back park, to the carport. But everybody just walked towards the center walkway and went into their houses, rain or shine. And they got out, going out the common drives on both sides of the property line.
But I think the philosophy, the idea of it, and as we talk about walkability, the car needs to be a secondary consideration. And you make it more about the interaction between individuals and the space that they're in. And I will say this as someone who periodically is blasted by fumes coming in the door from the exhaust of the neighbor driving by. It's kind of nice to have those cars at a distance so that, you know, have your windows open while you're sitting watching the world go by and inhale somebody else's fumes.
If you live in the city, you're glad you even have a space like that.
Exactly.
Otherwise, you're walking a few blocks.
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right. Anything else on page 10? Page 11. I just had a question on H, pedestrian flow through development. Should link all buildings to the public right-of-way, common open space and parking areas. Is there like a pathway design standard that we have that we can refer to, or do we need to have one there?
That's a good question.
They do all have to meet ADA.
And we have our sidewalks, but we don't have anything like, no. So if you want these to be...
Like, should there be a width requirement at least? Mm-hmm. And a type of material?
That's where you see, you know, that's where you start standardizing things. Like,
I think of it as like a sidewalk, except mm-hmm. it's a connecting path.
This is where I was talking about having somebody staring at my front window. This is the very paragraph that I was referring to. I'm convinced now that's not going to be as onerous as it could be, because the public will be often divided by vegetation and so on, so they won't be so much in front of my window. They're going to be off at a distance where they probably can't see through a darkened window. But I'm, in my own mind, seeing things I haven't seen before. A week ago, I wouldn't have seen this. The way you showed me those pictures and talking about tonight, I see it much differently.
That's great. Yeah.
I'm not such a curmudgeon after all. I was feeling like this is not going to work, and then it does work.
Something new.
Did we get into pervious surface?
We did.
This was not.
Yeah, there was a section in there about 50%.
Oh, pervious concrete are you talking? I mean, you're talking about pervious.
Well, so we're going to get into the trails, walking connectivity.
Yeah.
I'm thinking it's one thing to have an asphalt path versus gravel versus something that's pervious.
Yeah. I don't know. See, I actually am really... in my personal landscaping style, so if I'm off the street, not public driveway, I actually really like pathways that kind of have natural movement to them, and so whether that's like flagstone moving through the site or, you know, so I'm reluctant to say if they need to be 4 feet concrete, this or that, because I actually think they have to meet ADA, so you're ultimately allowing a lot of creativity. The worst would be if somebody wanted to do a 3 foot one, and actually that would maybe meet it. So, if, you know, we could say a minimum 4 feet and let them design it if you feel that. But I wouldn't go too far into pervious, just because what I'm seeing a lot with the pervious sidewalks right now is they're super mossy.
And they're plugged up.
Yeah, well, and I'm not sure if they're slippery, but boy, do they look mossy right now. So I've been kind of pondering what I think about how that's affecting.
Well, I think a pathway is going to drain off anyway, so it's not.
While you're pondering that, let me tell you, I almost killed somebody today. He was jogging on a very narrow shoulder of North Bend Way.
Uh-huh.
Don't know why the hell he wasn't doing this on the Snoqualmie Trail, but he was choosing to run there. He had total dark clothes on. All he had was a little blinker on the front of his headgear for his forward view. I didn't see him until I was almost up his butt.
He was running, jogging. Back to the lights?
He was running
back to the lights, running, you know, instead of running with the lights coming at him, he was running with his back to the lights.
Oh, boy.
All in black, and I didn't see this
guy. Are wizards out there, no doubt.
And I could have hit him just a foot closer to the line, I would have put him up. Mm. So that scared the hell out of me.
Yeah.
And I wanted to bring it up tonight because it just bothers me that we're not finding ways to have people use these trails that we're trying to think they will use when they're using a 4 foot wide fog line trail.
Well, yeah, no, this is different. You're right. You're right about that. So this is definitely in that little park area. So this is that picture I showed you. I'll show you the sidewalk. I was trying to find you guys a picture. I was in West Seattle not too long ago, just parking, going to a restaurant, and I looked over, and there was the coolest little cottage development. And it literally, the houses might have been only like, I don't know, maybe 25 feet apart, and the porch was, you know. So literally, if I was standing, I mean, it was so tight, but it was so well done. I thought, I just found it the picture doesn't, it's not worth showing you guys. So, back to the pathway. This is the pathway. I don't know if you can see it, but it's the one that rotates through the... But it's the one that wrote, you know, that you would actually walk. Let me see if I can get back through it.
But this particular individual, he was very lucky out of his own neighborhood. He looked like he was doing a long distance run, maybe 5-10 miles before work. Because he was pretty geared up. He had reflective gear on, but it was all in the front. Nothing in his back. So he was reflective of all that. He should have been running on the other side of the road, it seems to me, for his own safety. But maybe he thought he was
being kind to the cars. He ran out of light.
Yeah. I don't know. I just pointed it out that we have a very unsafe street system in our...
Our walkability isn't quite what we want.
No, it's not.
You get it there. Do you guys want... Are you guys wanting to add something to pedestrian connections of not less than 4 feet?
Why?
Do you want to add a dimension?
I would think, don't we require 6 feet sidewalks?
We require 5 foot sidewalks on the street.
Okay.
Internally, you could do a smaller one, and a 4 foot one internally would actually be okay.
I don't see people running through these cottage neighborhoods at all. I see them out on the main street.
Yeah. This is more just to walk your groceries out to the street or whatever.
These tables are 8 feet?
Yeah.
So it would be like half?
Mm-hmm. It should be wide enough for people to pass without someone having to step on the grass. Let's put it that way.
Yes, however, if you put 2 5-foot sidewalks like at Daniel's Grove where they have, mm-hmm. all of a sudden, because you want to create quaint space and without painting. So if you all of a sudden say this is your little, you have a 5-footer here and a 5-footer mm-hmm. here, you know, it's
cutting
there, you know, yeah. Like I have a 4-foot path. I have a detached garage, so I walk through the rain, and I have to walk pretty, you know, quite a ways down a little hill. I got a 4-foot path, and I don't know. I walk up to my garage with people, and we're good. It's all, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the, I think, that the way you'd be using that space.
So I'm kind of open. I just think if we don't specify it, are we going to end up with a 3-foot?
Well, what is ADA?
Stone path.
36 inches?
Yeah.
Oh, and it has to be of, a surface that you can roll on.
So. Why don't we just specify 4 feet, a minimum? Okay.
I just think if you're going to go off a trail and you have one of those big wheeled strollers too, that's going to take up 3 feet.
But would you be comfortable if there's the flexibility if there's a significant tree or a mature tree that they can narrow it down to go around? Or
I would think that this is an internal trail where it can meander,
right.
And Gary, be accommodating to the trees.
Mm-hmm. How about this concept?
Yeah.
If you're running down the road on a double wide story. You should be willing to sort of step off the side and let your pastor then continue. And then we want to build a wide enough walk so you can both share the road.
Oh, yeah.
Have somebody step aside so you can make your way.
Yeah, even with a big stroller, a 4 foot wide isn't wide, though.
Yeah.
You know, honestly, I mean,
we have a double.
Yeah.
It's 36 or 40.
I think of this more of a path, though. This isn't a sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
This is like... surrounding a green, it's a common area, so I'm going over to get a wine opener from my neighbor who I'm good friends with. I don't need a tarmac, you know, to walk across.
But
I think I'd prefer to have more grass out there so we can commune in a comfortable, you know, and if we've got a limited space and now a foot by however much of that, 50, is gone to concrete because we said... that it needs to be I like the idea of like a flagstone meandering path that
we don't say material, just width.
No, but like having that opportunity to make it unique and not the same as the sidewalk throughout the city. So having it be more narrow and, I don't know, backyardy rather than side of the streety.
That's actually the difference. So I actually think it creates a nice hierarchy. You go from the 4-foot path, and even Lynn used an example, like we've shrunk path sidewalks down to go around a significant tree. So that could happen where you go around, and then you get out to the sidewalk, and now you're on a bigger connection, and then you get to the arterial, and you're on now an 8-foot, you know. Mm-hmm. So it kind of provides this, okay, this is a quaint little backyard feel.
So the other thing that would send to the person who doesn't live there is, this isn't the same path, you are not welcome.
Good point.
Right,
yeah,
and it distinguishes privacy.
You know, and something you might think about, have your arborist think about this too, is we have significant trees near paths. Mm-hmm. Stop the sidewalk and use natural materials. The root balls on cedar and fir, they begin to rise above ground as they grow up, and they tend to rock around with the wind, and that's going to basically fracture your sidewalk. You got to give the area around your trees room to grow, which means probably I'm not want to put a sidewalk near it. So at some point, just stop with the sidewalk and have a trail, and then go back on the sidewalk, or have gravel, whatever. But use your common sense about this living thing that's not going to stay static. It's going to grow and grow, and your sidewalk gets in the way.
I like that. That's a good way to look.
Rather than taking the darn tree down.
Yeah.
Is there a way to put that in language, though, that using alternative materials that are appropriate for preservation of trees?
Yeah.
And allow. And I'm coming around to letting them go down to 3 feet to go around trees. Because as you look, I'm staring at that over there, the little drawing with 5 feet, and thinking even 4 feet takes up a lot of that green. And the idea of the separation, that visual feel of you're now in private space.
Mm-hmm. It's probably the same footprint of two of the dwellings.
Okay, why don't we ponder whether...
And I'll bet you the neighbors or the owners would appreciate the fact that you're saving that space for that tree to grow into.
Yeah, don't worry so much about when there's a tree, because what we do through the planning and engineering is we can flex slightly to preserve an amenity or a significant tree or something like that. So I think right now, why don't I put 4 feet in right now, but between now and our next meeting, just kind of check out when you're on a path. I'm going to actually measure mine at home because it's comfortable. I'll see if it could be actually 3 feet for all I know. And then let's come back and revisit whether 4 feels good or maybe really we don't need to say anything. But so right now we have 4 in there as the placeholder. Just as a time check, because Lynn does have another topic on the agenda, and it's somewhat, are you guys thinking?
Well, I'm winding down on anything I have. I don't know how the rest of the commission is, but
let me check the notes. I said all I had to say about this section. Are you talking about the water and sewer?
Yes.
Yeah. So I just had a question on page 12. I don't know if anybody has anything on 11. Okay. Views, buffered streets, and terminus and trails. We're talking about having views, and then we're talking about type 2 landscaping, where you have cedars and Douglas firs that have page 12, D.
Okay.
So you're talking about views and having a view, and then type 2 landscaping where you have cedars and Douglas firs that branches that stretch 10, 12, you know, feet each. And I'm just wondering, you know, a view is one thing and preserving trees is another. I don't know that they go hand in hand.
Good question.
Yeah.
So
it's almost opposing.
Okay, so this is kind of, there's a couple different thoughts in this, and maybe we haven't nailed it. So you drive down Cedar Falls, and the cool thing about having Mount Sairon is the view is almost always there. You know, I could be standing by one of the biggest trees, and I'm like, oh, there's Mount Sairon. So one of the things is kind of the quality of our views are so upward versus maybe outward. And then when the, so what we're trying to create is if you're driving down Cedar Falls, you have the line of trees. So you still, as you look up the new neighborhood's entry road, the terminus of the road is a treed area, and then the mountain sits in the back. So theoretically, you could, theoretically in a perfect world, you drive down Cedar Falls where there'd be houses sprinkled in there, you'd see Mount Si, but every time you look down a road, you'd still see trees. And that's why we're trying to couple them all together, if that makes sense.
It does. I'm just trying to,
Canopy Road.
Who in your shop has talked about pruning those trees about 25 feet up?
Which trees? The ones on Cedar Falls?
The mature trees on Cedar Falls Road. Just prune them up about 25 feet. There's still got plenty of crown.
Yeah, right now they've been on private property, so we haven't been thinking about it.
But have you thought about that as providing that view you're talking about, just pruning the lower limbs up?
Well, that could be part of this code, is in order to create a view on your Type 2 landscaping, is they can be trimmed up to 25 feet.
So the view that you're thinking of, you're on the ground, and so you mean the visual view through?
The through view.
Yeah, I'm thinking not only Mount Si, but Rattlesnake behind me. Or depending on which way I'm looking, right? It's both ways.
So do you think...
Visualize yourself sitting in your cottage at a dinner table, and you can look through your window and see Si because you've got your
window you have enough for you.
And it lets more light in, and it cuts down the loss.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely that is allowed. We could allow that naturally to be done through site review, because pruning trees can happen, and normally that is what.
If you have a homeowners association, they can prune the trees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I mean.
But I mean, you shouldn't have a code that would not allow it. I think that would be.
We don't.
They're their trees. Yeah. They just can't take them out.
Right.
You said 25 feet.
Whatever.
I got to get a taller ladder.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of nice to have the vegetation there for some property owners, depending on where your house is. It buffers you from the cars as well.
Sure.
So.
That was my only, I think that's my remaining.
No. Okay.
There's more.
The thing about pruning though, Lynn, is maybe not that, but let's get with some of the sale that you get with limbs around here. Mm-hmm. The lower limbs, which are always the biggest limbs, they get pushed hard by the wood. If you take them out, you don't pretty much get it gets through there fairly easier.
Okay, I'm on page 13, and it's item number 2, which starts on page 12 and goes to page 13, and it talks about an 8-foot meandering multi-purpose trail along Cedar Falls Way. And I thought we were at 6 feet for some reason for sidewalks, but we're at 5. So I'm wondering, how do we ask for an 8-foot trail? Like, is that just, like, how did that come about? Mm-hmm. Or
so, yeah. We're at 5 feet on residential local access. We're on 6 feet on collectors and arterials. We actually get to even 13 and what have you. So the type of the road, the sidewalk widens. So on North Bend Way, for example, we do have sections of sidewalk that are 13 to 10. So Cedar Falls, what we're trying to do is follow our trail standard that's in our parks aspect. And what we're hoping to do is bring this trail through the trees, and it would actually be a trail where you could really comfortably have, you know, two adults walking with two kids on the bikes, you know. So it's almost more of an amenity than just a walkway.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's like a rec path.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great.
Exactly.
Great.
And it's, well, you know, ideally, you know, if you think about North Bend, we got a great opportunity to have Canner Trail, Cedar Falls with a super, you know, super awesome, a wonderful trail. And then you have our Snoqualmie Valley Trail. So, you know, we have these three very...
As the crow flies, kind of.
Yeah.
As the crow
flies. Yeah.
I take more visualizing, we fall in love with Canner Trail. I just...
Yeah.
I don't see it working.
Oh.
I don't see it working. It's just, it's too much like a walk along the freeway. It's just too much of that.
Yeah, we'll have to see how you know, it's all about landscaping. You know, you can really create great spaces. And
I think the trail is a great way to land bank the third and fourth lane from North End Way.
Yeah, that might.
But you're walking yourself out of that by having the builder building up into it. You know, I think you ought to just get rid of that notion and just land bank that trail for a future road widening.
We got to save room for the light.
I'll give you that. I'll give you that advice for nothing. What's that?
So we got to save room for the light rail when that gets out here.
The light rail would be great down there.
I will say, when there was a sign across Tanner Trail for the Polygon to put their new home sign coming soon, we got immediately phone calls. Not every hour, but probably got 5 phone calls in one day about people who walk it. That trail, the Tanner Trail, saying that they had to walk out into the street, so that we had to get them to move their sign. Or ask them to, because actually it's their land, so they didn't have to move it. But they were willing to, which was nice. So there are people that use it informally as a trail. And
they do use it informally, and I see that.
Yeah.
You know, I see that a lot. And they aren't really trail walkers. They're people who just are walking. Mm-hmm. When I think of the people who are actually walking, hiking, you know, doing a walk, they're dressed for it. These people are... Oftentimes are women. I see ladies walking that in long dresses.
So it's an option. It's another option for a different
group. But it's a place to walk. It's grass. Mm-hmm. It's comfortable. It's not such an open thing. Mm-hmm. But
I think people feel safe there, too. I know a number of women who don't feel safe on the Snoqualmie Valley Trail.
Yeah, it's super visible. Exactly. You know, you've got nice. Maybe if it were formal, your jogger would be up there on it.
And you know... Chris, you're so right about that. There's a lot of concern about the homeless people using Snoqualmie Trail for their motor transportation. They sleep out there. They hang out there, and the average person knows that, and they don't want to deal with that. So they find other ways to go.
Right. That's nice to have an option.
So was that that was the end of it? Or
yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Did anybody else have anything?
So we're ready to move on to item number 5, Introduction to Sewer and Water Amendments for North Bend Municipal Code Title 13. Yeah. And welcome our wonderful planner, Ms. Lynn Hyde.
Thank you.
He's been on sabbatical.
I didn't feel like sabbatical for some reason. Yeah, I think... let's see. What we have here is our Title 13, and what we have been working to do here is there's been a number of sections that have been changed throughout the years and haven't been updated and haven't been really cleaned up. So we've gone through and we have combined sections to make it more readable for not only citizens, people that want to do a project, but for the staff as well. We've tried to clarify some confusing points in it and redundant or contradicting statements that are in it as well. And then there's also been some just a general discussion about moving forward for the future of North Bend. What do we want to see in this? So we're opening it up. This is an introduction today. I assume this will take a number of meetings for us to kind of talk about what we want, what we see, and the edits that we're going to be making to it. But so right now, the real meat of the edits that you see in here, the red line, is more cleaning it up. There's not a lot of substantial change that's happened. In fact, there's very little substantial change other than trying to make it just cleaner and more understandable for the user. It's been kind of a confusing code in the past to read. So that's where we are. And we can, did you get it how you want? We can go through it page by page or talk about it in a broader, more general, anything that you saw in there.
Well, I appreciate your introduction. Is there anything that you want to specifically call out versus it was mostly trying to simplify, but are there any other points that were needing to be addressed in here? I noticed just a lot of kind of simplification around the fees. But.
I think that the main, if you were to focus on one spot, I don't have anything. Like I said, there's not any real change in process and what's allowed at this point. What's in here, there's not that. But the sewer code has saw the most change in here. Mm-hmm. So there's a new table that was put in that will hopefully help users. As you know, I was looking for a map of where there's sewer and where there's not sewer in North Bend. There, we run into this every day where people are confused with what they can do, and the code is not very clear to help someone work through what they can do. And that's kind of what was the impetus for this, is how can we make this easier to read so someone can look and say, well, I'm on septic, I'm X number of feet away from sewer today, what can I do on it, or what would I need to do to be able to do what I want to do? It's been kind of complicated. So that's where there is a table that's been added that will hopefully make that more clear. And that is, let's see where that is. There's a lot of pages in this.
41, maybe?
If there's a table, that's it.
Is that page 20?
41 and 20.
Let's see, 41.
Oh, 41 and 20. 41. That's right.
Yeah, so this is something I think, yeah, would be one of the main changes that's been made is this. Yeah.
So, Lynn, were you looking for a map of the sewer system?
Right before I came to the meeting, I was looking for one because we had one printed up for a meeting we did, and I couldn't find it immediately. Like a big one, not like I couldn't find one in the city, but like we had a big one put on the board somewhere.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if it's even here, but I couldn't find it.
The only one I've seen, is it the same one that has the manhole covers on it?
You know, we did one when we did a Silver Creek meeting to talk about if a ULID would be, just to see how a ULID would be perceived there. So, and we had a map. Yeah.
So
I'm reading this carefully, I think I am. And as I was reading this, I was asking myself, what is Council Member Peterson going to think about the language, the very specific language? And she's thinking about a rural community, nice, friendly people, when we talk about taking people's homes because they're late paying for their sewer hookup. That's a very real thing, but it never dawned on me that that was a reality. But it talks about, you know, sewers being required, the owner has to pay for it, the owner has to float a loan and put the city on the deed, all this kind of stuff, and the late paying, the city can foreclose on that.
Is there
house.
A certain section you're looking at?
Just talking about, I grabbed a page and talked about sewers being required.
Mm-hmm.
Right now I'm in septic. I have a septic that's going to last me 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I could hook up to the sewer line that's right in front of my gate. I could do that for $30,000. But some people can't do that. Some people can't. They'd be forced into hooking a sewer up where they don't have the funds and they have a perfectly adequate septic.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently they're going to be forced to hook up. They've got to take a loan out and name the city as insured. And if they can't pay, the city can condemn. I mean, do we really want to say that?
Well, let's find that.
Well, I'm not sure.
So I've, if I've not misunderstood, I think there's a notice on title for the existence of the requirement to hook up in the future, and I think it's tied to either redevelopment or property transfer. It's not where an existing occupant slash owner would ever have to write a big check.
Well, and
as long as their septic is working. If it fails, different story. I think that's how it's.
So I think what you're talking about is a no protest letter. Is that what? And where it's a notice on title. So what we do have is if you need to make some modifications to your septic, if it fails and you need to build a new one, if you expand or if you really go in and just start to make modifications to your septic, the city will allow you to do that. The city does not want to take, condemn or make anyone's house not livable. That's actually one of the things that we thought was really important to make this clear. That's not what we were doing. So if you need to do something like that, the city will allow it. You have to permit. Everything has to be permitted through King County Department of Health. That's a permit that you come and show that you have their approval. The city will allow you to do it, but then you do sign a no protest letter that says if a ULID is proposed in this area, I will not protest it, I'll be in favor of it, and then I will hook up to sewer at that time. So that's something that does.
But even then, it's not the hookup at that time isn't like at the moment the sewer is available, it has to do with.
At that one, it actually is once the sewer is available, you will hook up. But I'm not sure if it's I don't know what the wind, I don't know that it's, you have to do it within 60 days or 90 days or a year. I'm not sure what the.
So I'm thinking of Wood River, for example. Mm-hmm. That was a ULID that was done fairly well orchestrated.
Oh, so ULID is a little
different. Every house in there has, I call it a knock on title that says, okay, somebody's got to deal with this someday, but no single owner, as long as they're living there.
That's different than the no protest letter.
Yeah.
The ULIDs are different.
Yeah. So when a ULID is proposed, there is an assessment, and that assessment gets defined with the ULID creation. That's, I think, what you're thinking of. But that's very different than.
And when the city annexed the Tanner.
Yeah.
It seemed like almost immediately you ran a sewer line down the middle of Tanner Road, mm-hmm. ending with the spur road going into the development. The homes at the end of Tanner who really need to be on sewer, they have half-acre septics, they don't even have a shot at it because it stopped short of their community back in there. Mm-hmm. But certainly it runs right in front of my house and Scott's house, and neither he nor I have any intention of hooking up to it, but also the city hasn't required us to. I just, at some point, it feels like the shoe's going to drop. That the city will come to us and say, we're going to ask you to hook up to it. And if I don't, then I get sideways with the city. And I'm thinking, well, don't put anybody who owns a home in this nice, friendly community that's going to have the city knocking on their door with a pretty rough story.
I don't know that North Bend has ever done that.
I don't think they've ever condemned.
But I know, yeah.
It's not condemning.
I don't know that North Bend's ever required anyone to hook up.
No, yeah, and there's not even discussion of condemning because somebody won't hook up.
But if they hook up, mm-hmm. because they've been required to hook up, mm-hmm. but they're not paying their hookup fees in a timely way, and they stop paying their fees, the city is in second position on the mortgage, and the city can take it. And I'm just wondering if the city would really take it, and not, why even play with that language?
I'm a little bit confused where that is. The only place I remember seeing that kind of language was with that sewer connection incentive program, which is where the city essentially gives a loan and becomes a creditor. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's different from, that's a separate thing.
Well, there is a section on page 42 that says all costs and expense, and it talks about, associated with installation of the connection shall be borne by the property owner, and the property owner shall indemnify the city from any loss or damage from that may directly or indirectly be associated with the installation of the sewer. That, a lot of times that's not new language. I don't know if that's where you're looking at.
Unless, Jenna, I'll have to call you. I'd like to call you back. I want to find it. Because it worried me that this language is actually in a public document. I think it's pretty well understood that a bank will take your house from you if you're not paying the mortgage. Mm-hmm. But having the city require you to hook up when maybe you're not able to afford it and you already have a means of living without it, it seems like the city's putting the homeowner in a very tough spot.
No, I'd appreciate it if you find that. Actually, what I'm realizing might be helpful is and let me know if you already understand it or are comfortable with it, but if we went through quickly and did almost a little education as to what this code means for each little, you know, just do like a really cursory education and discussion about it.
We need that. I just felt
because
like
it's confusing
getting,
and
I felt like we were getting shut down. I want to get that on the table.
Right. So right now, today in the city of North Bend, and sorry if this is common knowledge, but so the first section here says all new construction has to hook up to sewer. That's kind of the blanket statement. If you're building a single family house, commercial, any new structure has to hook up to sewer. Because North Bend doesn't have sewer spread throughout the city on all the roads, it gets more complicated than that. And so there's a lot of existing septic. So that's where you go through. And the first one says that existing structures that are already on septic can continue using the septic. And what's important that it says in here, and what I think everyone agrees is very important, is that if you have existing septic that fails, that you're able to fix it. Yeah, thanks. And so that's where this first one comes in. So expansions, remodels, restorations, alterations, or changes, you can do that. But once you do that, then there's things that come into play. So if you're within 200 feet of the sewer, you have to bring it to your house per our code today. If you're within 200 feet and you need to touch your septic, then you extend it to your house and you hook up to sewer. If you are within 200 feet and you don't need to touch your septic, you can continue using it just because you're within that, like you're within 200 feet now, but you don't have to hook up to it. And so you can continue on your septic. If you want to, another thing that's important, septics are measured by bedrooms. So you can have a bathroom, and that doesn't mean you have to expand your septic. It's only if you add a bedroom and King County says you're not sized for it. So that's some of the language in here talks about if you're expanding your house, but you don't increase in bedrooms, then you can, and you're further than 200 feet, you can continue using your septic. That's some of the language that's in the table that goes through it.
Would a homeowner be allowed to recertificate their septic? It's like, and 20 years, most drain fields play out. So you either need to generate a new drain field or develop a new drain field to continue on septic. When that point comes, is the city going to stand there in the way and say, no, we don't want you to do that, we want you to hook up?
So if you, make sure I'm answering, heard you right. If you have a septic that needs, I would call that maybe restoration. That sounds like it would fall under restoration to me. You are allowed to do that if you are greater than 200 feet from sewer.
The former homeowner shut down his lower drain field and put a new one up on the road, right next to the road. And it's got about a 20-year life to it before I have to start worrying about it. And it's 20 feet off the sewer line, this drain field.
Mm-hmm.
In 20 years, does the city have to not allow the homeowner, and I'll be dead by then, but have the homeowner have to hook up to sewer, or is that still going to be the option of the homeowner to regenerate?
Well, I don't, 20 years long is to know, but if that were to happen today, because you are within 200 feet of the sewer, the city would not allow you to repair, to put a new drain field or a new septic in. At that point, you would hook up to sewer.
Clarification on that 200 feet. Is that 200 feet from the house or 200 feet from the property line?
I think it's existing structure. Property line.
Yeah,
sorry.
Property line.
Sewer availability within 200 feet of property line.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So then moving on, I think, and we can come back to all of these. Another one that we've hit on that's a big topic is a ULIN. And I think you're probably all pretty familiar with this, but another option for a community or a neighborhood or a street or a subset of houses to get sewers through ULID, and that's where 60% of the appraised property values decide they want it to happen. And it's not 60% of the homeowners, but it's appraised value. And then in that case, again, it comes, then that's where you're paying the ULID assessment that we talked about before, and you each pay the proportion that amount to get the sewer and infrastructure there. jump in if I'm explaining anything incorrectly.
What does the ULID stand for?
Utility Local Improvement District.
Right.
So it can be something other than sewer.
Yeah, in a rural area like Tanner, I can see where that's going to take those 1 acre lots and they're going to go into fours right away. They have to get sewer.
For what area?
Tanner Roche. There's a lot of 1 acre lots right along the river.
Mm-hmm.
I can see where they will segregate into fours. right off the bat. If sewer, if they're forced into sewer, they're just going to subdivide and move on.
You sewer already exists on Tanner. You have sewer in front of your home, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm not hooked.
Nobody's requiring right now you to hook up. Right?
I know that.
Yeah.
But I know that.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying, but that's your concern.
My concern is for anybody in this city that's on septic that has a sewer nearby, if they're content with septic and they don't have any problems, there's no environmental problems with their septic, it's not leaking, nothing like that, it's being well maintained. But the city clearly has an objective to get as many people on sewer as possible to help pay for that thing. And I understand that too. It seems to me at some point the city's going to have a contest with a homeowner over finances on this. And oftentimes people who are in areas where they have septic probably don't have as much of an income as other people who do live on sewer. Just a wild guess on that. But it puts the city and the citizens in a contest. They never asked for the sewer. Maybe they did. I don't know. I'm just saying that this is where the rural becomes more of a city than a rural.
Possibly, but look at it a different way. If a city's not proactively, which this city's not proactively going out and saying, hey, get it in front of you, now, you know, we want you to hook up. If the city's not doing that, they're saying, okay, we're going to let you use the life of your septic. When your septic fails, you're going to have a choice to hook up with, you're going to be required to hook up to sewer, but what you're actually going to do is a new septic with new standards on a shoreline today is about a $30,000 to $40,000 investment. Connecting the sewer is about a $5,000 investment, then your rates after that. So in that scenario, the homeowner is going to be like on view because you're going to save from having to put in a whole new septic system.
And I know today, also on my septic system, the guy that came and emptied it last told me that if I did any home improvements or if this fails, that King County standards are now different and I would have to redo my system and put in another tank.
There's actually a number of lots where you can't even, you couldn't create it again on the same lot because it's not big enough or the standards have increased.
And there are additional expenses in many areas of the city. Well, in special flood hazard area, there are additional expense associated with having to replace the septic in those areas.
You said 20 years on a drain field?
Yeah.
19-year-old home.
Do they take care of it? It's a lot longer.
I had a question about a part that you just read. So, I wasn't following along, but it said residents will be charged like a proportional amount, right? So I guess what I'm wondering, how are those proportions calculated? I'm thinking like Elizabeth lives at the end of Thrasher, right? Which is a little bit, sort of, right? Not quite, yeah.
Close enough.
Which, I mean, if, just for example, sewer's coming down 6th, well, that's a little closer to the source than me all around Boxley. So you got to go a whole lot further to get there. So what's the proportion there?
Yeah, can you just describe?
It's if I recall right from one moment, it's your assessed value based on your highest and best use. So it's not based on how far the run is to you, because in theory, everybody is incrementally paying to get it to you. That's also it's your assessed value based on highest and best use.
Yeah. And that example right there is when we were talking about lot sizes, when we were talking about, well, if we go up to 10 or 15,000, you could no longer do 4 homes on an acre, which meant anybody in the ULID would have been assessed for 4, and they could now only do 3.
Right.
So they would have overpaid.
Okay.
And once an assessment is established, it can't be changed based on, like, if you downzone somebody, they don't go recalculate the whole assessment and charge everybody differently. It just is locked.
Okay.
So that's a drawback, too.
Well, there's another piece of the puzzle, too. So development happens beyond your property.
Yeah.
And the developer's required to bring in that infrastructure to their site to get their permits. So you're on the hook incrementally, but it's based on your property as a group to make the distance. Whatever the assessment distance is, right? So if it crosses your property and your neighbor's property, it's one each of the proportion. that you would pay to hook up down the road, whenever that needed to happen.
Right.
Or you chose to do it. So it's not like it's just going to sit out there and you've got a check to write. You know what I mean?
When you're dealing with development, a ULID is when there's a...
But the sewer line itself, it doesn't impact you just because it's in the street.
No.
The cost of getting it there was usually paid by a developer on the other end.
Right. Yeah, and the only way they can recoup is if they file a latecomer agreement. So as people hook up, they get paid back for their investment of...
Thank you, Lynn.
Jenna, that's very valuable. You have something more?
No, I was looking through to see. I think that's a pretty good start. It's a lot to take into account. The next part really goes more into the fees that have to be paid. So that, I think for the sewer section, this is really kind of the meat of it, the heart of it, that...
If we were all hooked up to sewer in the city of North Bend, the solid waste division would be in trouble, right? They don't have the capacity to take all the sewage.
That's not
that what... That could come. So is this chapter is being rewritten, obviously, for inclusion, but what about, when is the solid waste division going to get their facility upgraded to handle the new affluent that's going to become an anthem?
Yeah, that's a... So, with developments that come, every time a development comes or a new home's built, they have to ensure that there is capacity at the wastewater treatment plant. And so that's a process that's gone through. And they do have in the pipeline, and I don't know if they've included every home in the pipeline when they do the modeling, but they know...
We basically have enough to handle what we have in the pipeline plus some extra. And I can't remember what that is. It's like 200-300 units. But the improvements that the city are scheduling in will get the treatment plant the capacity needed, and then there's to continue to accept applications if people want to develop. Then there's beyond that, there's redundancy, and that's safety measures that go beyond. So there's a very elaborate plan of how we're doing this, and we're, you know, it's more in the public works world, but basically we'll be able to handle the growth we have in the pipeline plus a little bit more in the meantime, which is about a 3-year window. There's going to be improvements made that will give you more capacity and redundancy.
But as a planning group, you know, how many residences do we have in the community that are on septic now? There aren't new buildings, they're existing structures, not even thinking about the new homes that are coming down the pipeline, but in the community, what percentage of our citizens are living with septic systems that are going to be refreshed and ready to go online with sewers? I mean, is that being also part of the expansion plans of the solid waste system? Mm-hmm. It's not just the new homes to think about. There's all these other homes that have septics that are going to be going on the sewer line.
We plan based on the capacity at build-out, basically.
I thought it was based on our land use element where we had modeled capacity. That's what it's ultimately going to meet.
Yeah.
Which was like 12,000.
Our population is 14, yeah.
But we have existing homes that should be thought of as new homes when it comes to sewers.
Absolutely, yeah. You're right on it.
So that additional capacity from the existing homes is being taken into account. Mm-hmm. Good.
What's the latest and greatest on the moratorium?
Would you be talking cottage? About the cottage or the wireless?
Sewer related.
We don't have a moratorium.
Well, there was a capacity conversation a year ago.
Yeah, there was a capacity issue. There was some improvements made. We have right now the wastewater treatment plant is functioning at an ability to handle the pipeline of projects we have, plus about 300-400, I think. But in the window of that is going to be the improvements to carry it on. So, yeah.
Okay, and you mentioned, what was the other one?
Mm.
The community communications.
Oh, wireless facilities.
Oh, you guys are going to be getting another Lynn Knight. She's going to bring some amendments to our wireless communications chapter. It's a little behind times and needs to be updated.
Okay. So we are approaching 9 o'clock, and we haven't gotten to page one yet. How's my planning commission doing?
And remember, you have at least a number of meetings to come on this one, so this is a good education night as well.
Mm-hmm. So, Chair, I think we've got a great little intro so far. Covered the mass topic.
Okay.
I'm about at cognitive capacity.
Okay. All right. Good of the order.
I have a question for you, because this is floating around with everyone now that Snoqualmie's got their little hotel conversation going on. Hmm. Where are we on our joy on the corner?
So they have not been able to do any work specifically with the hiring and the timing here. So the plan is that they'll start progress in April. There is a water line that needs to be removed and what have you. They have a new project manager who seems to be doing a good job. So we expect it to start moving again this spring. They've actually said, the owner said it was his highest priority based on the 15 hotels I believe he is involved in. So we were told that this is the highest priority. So.
Excellent.
Hopefully that will be the case.
Anything further? Okay, I just want to let the Planning Commission know I will not be at the February 23rd meeting.
Wow. Oh,
my second one to miss.
I know. This doesn't happen often, guys.
So.
Yeah, I won't be here either.
So we have two down that night?
It's midwinter break.
Yeah. Where are you going?
Taking the kids to see grandmas and grandpas.
Okay. Well, if the rest of you think that for whatever reason you wouldn't be there, let us know.
The 23rd is a meeting?
Yeah.
That would be our second meeting of February.
Yeah. Well, that might be a quorum issue then, because I'll be gone also.
You're going to be gone?
In Costa Rica.
I won't
be here. Good for you.
Zip lining.
Oh, that's going to be your zip lining.
So the week before or the week after?
That's when the public hearing is going to be for septic, so we might want to.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll be back the next week.
And we're gonna do a public. So on the cottage, you guys are at a point where you're probably ready to do a public hearing. Okay. I'll have to look at the schedule.
Is everybody here on the 9th?
Yes.
Not I. So the fly.
Jenna, any news on the council retreat that you can share?
Yeah, it was actually a great retreat. They spent a lot of time talking about just their vision. And I felt like it's a vision that, I think has they've stayed the city, we've all kind of had stayed the course in the realm of wanting to stay small town, rural character. So, we'll be coming to you with, we've been holding off on a number of land use issues waiting for this retreat to happen, and one of those is the docket process. So we kind of went through with them the zoning map and talked about every area and, what we saw if we saw some zoning changes. So we're going to go, bring the dockets back, which will kind of open up the zoning map, and then bring to you some of those recommendations. Really, I didn't see anything drastically different than what we've actually already talked about. In fact, some of it kind of, I would say, even would reflect what you proposed back in previous years, like the higher density in front of Torgerson Park, for example, and those kind of things. So that is happening. That they kind of all talked about having they want to consolidate or focus multifamily or higher density to downtown where the services are, and
as we go down North Bend Way in our NB zone, our neighborhood business zone, they wanted to see more mixed-use style versus residential, commercial, versus standalone residential.
Excellent.
And so we have a moratorium on single-family in the NB zone, so we're going to have to staff that coming back through to you guys. So I see that coming through probably end of March. So what I'm hoping to kind of do is we'll spend a month or two staffing it, and what I'd like to do is come with a package so you can kind of see it all together. But it's actually going to be a pretty big package because it'll be a zoning map.
Yeah.
So it might be Jim.
Good to the order.
Thank you for that. Just with the docket process, will we get the list again of where we go through and say yes or no, and then we have each one at subsequent meetings, or how?
Yeah, thinking through the docket list, I think ultimately we're going to go through them all just because of the kind of the need to. I think it's good to go through this exercise where we reconfirm our vision and tweak it where we need to. I think that's a normal process that a growing cities do, and so ultimately I think you'll touch on them all. So
great. Commissioner Ryan.
This has been a growing thorn in my side, and I just really need to ask the staff about it. Is it the small town nature, like North Bend or even Snoqualmie or others, where the city council does the actual visioning, and then the various commissions do the wordsmithing on whatever they come up with? I always had the impression that commissions like us make proposals, and the city councils do the consenting part. It seems to be reversed. I just want to understand that.
Yep.
You're talking about the city council providing, you know, doing planning on such and such, and that we're going to get a chance to look at it. It seems like that should be reversed in some way. Where have I been misled?
Can I just say, from the chair's perspective, I think our duty is to figure out what the best path is for us to proceed forward based on our citizens' feedback and our views in developing the city. It's up to the city council whether or not they take our recommendation. I find that consistent with what I've seen in Snoqualmie and in Issaquah City Council going against. They have a planning and policy commission. They have, I don't know all the names, but they have one for like their bridge development. And they've gone against their recommendations quite a few times.
That's what I've seen, but at least they're taking action. But what I'm saying is that it seems as though in our arrangement, is the city council seems to be driving the planning process, and the commission is doing the checks and balances.
Well,
and I want to understand that dynamic better.
Yeah, I actually think it would. The way I look at it more is, they want to hear from you guys. There's nobody on the city council, I think, that's sending things, input or direction back. They're actually, the way I look at it is, these are the starting points, because whether it's the planning staff that comes to you with the starting point or a council who gives feedback, you're going to get the starting point, and from that starting point, you're going to provide your recommendation. And so I personally think you could look at it as this is helping you guys understand where they're coming from. That doesn't mean you guys have to be on the same page. You can stand on your own recommendation. But at least you have, because, one thing that I've struggled with a little bit is, until they could come together at their retreat, I thought, well, I think I know what this person likes. I kind of think I know what that person likes. But what would they collectively like? And that's what everybody, even developers, need to know. So as we do this, I think this is just here's where your starting point is. Give us build it. They're asking you guys to build it and then provide the recommendation of the built product back.
But I would think that our role, we heard, I remember the meeting that Council Member Peterson says she wants rural community out here. Mm-hmm. That should have been enough for us to take the ball with you and find this Kirkland neighborhood? Why is it that they found the Kirkland and are pushing it down to us? Why aren't we pushing it up to them? It seems that we should be doing that.
I remember at that meeting where she brought out a newspaper article as a reference of somebody that she liked as an award-winning cottage developer. That's where it just got started.
Yeah, unless my memory's faded, I'm fairly certain cottage housing zone did not originate in the city council. It came from one of our meetings. Mm-hmm. And it was talked about and then went out to city council and forgot about it for probably 6 months and it got worked back the other way. So in that particular case, I'm pretty sure they didn't come up with the idea. We did.
Yeah, I mean, I could give you the long and the short of it is there was a commission put together way back in almost 2006, I think. And it was, I think, driven by the planning commission. This is actually before my time. So when I came here in 2006, there was this kind of somewhat of a cottage code in place. But it was, John Day was on the commission, a couple planning commissioners. Anyway, then in 2006, it was about, oh, we're going to come out of moratorium, let's really create an affordable opportunity. So believe it or not, since 2006 or 7, whenever we amended it the first time when I was here, we've amended, this is going on the third or fourth time. So this is an evolving code, partly because the market of small houses has, with the economy, has done that, right? So, I see this more as a collaboration of both boards over the years and zoning a very difficult land use issue.
And I share your frustration in the concept, but I think, for me, I'll just blame myself, because I could be attending more city council meetings. I could be convincing them of what my or our perspective is. And I think it does go both ways. We're doing a dance all the time. They may have one city council member may say something that starts the ball rolling, or we may come up with an idea from something else we're doing, and it gets started the ball rolling. So I appreciate your point. I get frustrated too, because I feel sometimes we spend all our time just evaluating something they sent down for us to look
at. You're causing me to wonder that whether or not prior planning commissions actually had, or planning commissioners had a conflict of interest actually being on the commission. They were the actual builders and developers of the community.
No.
Well, you said John Day was on it. John Day.
No. He was on the subcommittee that helped talk about what is a cottage, how do you pencil a cottage. There was a committee, a subcommittee put together way back when to even start the discussion, just like we're going to do about affordable housing, because affordable housing is something that. You know, like personally, I think cities that do it right hire affordable housing specialists because it's that unique of an aspect. That's what the city did way back, a long time ago, but they used volunteer citizens.
The first planning commission, which hasn't been that long ago, the commissioner on that commission was Dick Zimp, who clearly boosted the revenue for City North Bend, and that was clearly a conflict of interest. But nobody seemed to talk about it. But I wonder if it's just gotten, if it's changed or if it's still the same. If the Planning Commission has a cloud of conflict of interest perceptions, because it would bother me if we did.
No, it just
seems like we should be more involved in the planning process than in the editing process, which is what I think I'm doing most of the time, is reading 80 pages just to edit it and wordsmith it.
Well, no matter what, think of it more this way. Regardless of who's going to bring the first starting point, we really want to build a better product. So every time I walk over to Lynn's desk and I say, hey, Lynn, what do you think about this? I end up walking away with more wealth to put into something. And that's what we're doing collectively by using all, the council, getting kind of their perspective for you to start with. That doesn't mean you guys shouldn't put your own picture in it and change it and do what you need to do.
So, Commissioner Ryan, to your point, I have also wanted to do some things on this planning commission, like a 20-year plan for the city, but I am told, if this is not correct, that I need the city council to buy into that before I can get our commission to work on that. We have done our comprehensive plan that is kind of our
long-range planning for that 10, 15-year horizon. But I wanted to think about 20 and 40 years down the road, you know, putting some ideas together, have some citizen workshops, and, you know, build it out a little bit and see what it looks like.
The main thing is, even on the council, if one council member has something they want, it has to be confirmed by everybody from a priority standpoint. So what it's doing is making sure any individual who's in the system doesn't start dictating priorities and workload and that, what have you. So the city moves in the direction of the decided priorities.
It's by definition a collaborative process.
What's that?
It's by definition a collaborative process. Mm-hmm. So I think the council often pushes vision to us. They're the ones who are the public face of the city. They're hearing feedback. And I think a lot of what ends up coming back to us that, okay, this is what we're being told. This sounds cool. Why don't you guys figure out how to make it work? And I do think we spend a lot of time editing, but I also think that we spend a lot of time shaping kind of the vision into something that we think makes more sense and that takes that kind of overall 1,000-foot view and turns it into what you're going to see on the street. Not that they always take our advice when it gets back to them, but we try.
Well, and just maybe a different take on that is maybe they're just kicking it to us, and we're assuming that we need to do the wordsmithing when, in fact, like, that's not the limitation, right? So maybe if we put a little bit more creativity into it, we'll see more of these ideas get accepted. Who knows?
Well, I think one of the things that we keep trying to get back to, we've talked about doing gateway plan for mm-hmm. a while, mm-hmm. and that can keeps getting kicked, and I think it's part of that overall picture, and maybe it's going to fit into one of the many things that is coming our way right now.
Well, one thing we are going to do is, part of that is resources too. I mean, mm-hmm. we really, we're really trying to balance reactionary government versus proactive. Mm-hmm. And what we are doing, though, we did get the council approved $48,000 to do the gateway out at exit 34. So we've been working on an RFQ that's going to go out, and there's going to be a public SHRET process. We're still trying to figure out how that's defined and where that goes, but definitely Planning Commission, you're going to be part of that stakeholder group that provides input on that gateway. So if we do it right, what would be nice is we could kind of build the foundation of gateway similarities at each. Or maybe we don't want to, because sometimes it's unique to, you know, because that's going to be a unique exit with the middle forms. Anyway, that's a good
it's a discussion.
Yeah.
Okay, lastly, before we adjourn, if you didn't get an email from me because of the last meeting, I can still send it out if you are not set up on our email system, the new one.
Send it. Yeah, please send it.
I did to you.
Are you on?
You didn't? Okay, so no, after the meeting, let's just powwow for a second. I'll get your email addresses.
Before we adjourn, I was looking for copies. Were the minutes approved from the last meeting?
Yep. Yes.
Okay. Signature when we're done. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anything further? Motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second?
Yes.
Okay. Motion by Curtis Von Chopp. Second by Commissioner Ryan. All those in favor of adjourning, say aye.
Aye.
Commission is adjourned, 9:15.